MacCast, Monday, April 23rd, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geek by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. I hope you're having a great day. I hope you had a nice weekend. I had a particularly nice weekend. The weather was pretty good here, although this morning it's a little bit cloudy and rainy. But I just hung out and didn't do a whole lot over the weekend, and that's how I really like to spend my weekends. You know, when you're running around and busy, it gets a bit crazy. So just to be able to enjoy some time off is always really nice. But we're back here. It's Monday. We're in the thick of things. We've got a ton of Apple and Mac news to cover. Lots of stories going on. Apple building up to their second quarter earnings call, which is happening tomorrow. So we'll be listening in on that and getting all the details about how Apple's doing. We'll talk a little bit about some of the predictions and some of the other news that's going on, of course. But before we get into all of that, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that's Smile. You know, I'm a big fan of all of Smile's products, but Text Expander is one of the earliest ones that I used. Well, beyond Disk Label, I guess I should be on. Disk Label was probably the first one that I owned. But Text Expander is the one that I'm using day in and day out to get a lot of stuff done. And there's so many great features in there. Essentially, what it allows you to do is set up little abbreviated snippets that when you type them in any application, anywhere in the operating system, they expand into larger blocks of text. So they can save you a ton of time in typing, especially if you or in any kind of situation where you type the same thing over and over again. And that could be lots of different applications. A very common one is if you have multiple signatures in email. Yes, you can build that into your email client, but it's just as easy to set those up in Text Expander. Plus, Text Expander has some additional features to allow you to be a little bit more dynamic with what you do. So one of the really powerful features I've started to come to rely on in Text Expander is something called fill-ins. It's one of my favorite power features, and what it gives you is a dynamic fill-in areas that you can put into your snippets that will pop up at expansion time. So when you hit that abbreviated snippet, it'll pop in and give you the opportunity to insert dynamic information into that snippet. So it's great for inserting personalized information like, say, names in an email response that you might be sending. So just one of the great features that's in Text Expander. They also have Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, so you can sync your snippets back and forth. You can use them in a whole host of applications that include the Text Expander APIs, the Text Expander Touch APIs. There's an ever-growing list you can check out on Smile's website. You can also go there and get a free trial of Text Expander. So check it all out, smilesoftware.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. We're going to kick things off this week with a story from across the pond. Apple is expanding its workforce in Cork, Ireland. This is according to a Reuters article. Apple will increase the headcount at its European headquarters in the southern city of Cork by up to 500 employees over the next 18 months. The offices there currently employ about 2,800 employees and provide distribution, supply chain management, and back office functions. The new jobs are good news for the region, which has seen some growth over the past year. 9to5 Mac notes that RTE News Ireland reported revenues in the markets handled by the Cork headquarters grew about 55% year over year in the October and December timeframe. Apple's moving forward on a new data center in Oregon. Apple plans a $250 million investment on 160 acres of land in Prineville, Oregon. I think I told you about this on a past MacCast. Apple has also pledged to pay the local governments there $150,000 a year and will receive a 15-year property tax exemption. In exchange, Apple states it will create a minimum of 35 jobs at the center and that the average wages on those jobs will be 150% of the average wage in Cook County, where the facility is located. The new data center is also expected to be environmentally friendly, but will start small. The first building will be just 10,000 square feet and part of 8 modular data center units. The later facility will be constructed on the same site. As for the new facility being green, like the term 4G, Apple may find itself in a bit of a semantics argument once again. Apple is currently at odds with Greenpeace over the green moniker for the massive data center in Maiden, North Carolina. Greenpeace claims that despite the solar farm and on-site fuel cell technologies, it still relies mainly on dirty coal-based power. Apple contends that the organization is actually grossly overestimating the facility's power consumption requirements and ignoring the fact that 60% of the power will come from on-site renewable energy resources. This is not the first time, however, that Greenpeace and Apple have been at odds, and I would venture to guess it won't be the last. And as I was alluding to, this is not the only area where Apple is at odds with someone over the definition of one of their marketing terms. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission has accused Apple recently of misrepresenting the third generation iPad's wireless data capabilities by including the term 4G. Apple is now arguing, though, that the issue is Australia's 3G networks are simply mislabeled. What's really at issue seems to be the definition, which Apple says is defined by the International Telecommunications Union. In December, that union expanded the definition of 4G to allow HSPA Plus networks to gain the moniker. That is supposedly why Apple adjusted the iOS menu bar badging to display 4G on AT&T iPhones in the States, something that I think also caused confusion in this market. Since all three major Australian carriers support the UMTS standard on the 21 MHz band, Apple is contending that this is 4G and that the branding is valid. Apple also mentioned that they changed all advertising and signage on the new iPad in the region to stipulate that it does not support LTE networks. A similar issue and consumer confusion, as well as complaints, also exist in the United Kingdom. The issue remains that even if you separate the 4G versus the LTE monikers, consumers are very likely to become confused. Apple does carefully market its new iPad on its website as having Wi-Fi plus 4G with support for 4G LTE. The text is very subtle, but my guess is that it's also very deliberate. It seems to me that Apple is playing marketing word games, and my belief is that much of it is to keep their carrier partners like AT&T happy. Personally, I don't like it very much, and I do agree with the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission that it does cause confusion among consumers. Apple's argument, while possibly technically valid if you accept the ITU's definition, seems counter to their mission of making things simple for consumers. They could have simply stated something like, runs on the fastest wireless networks available, or something to that effect. Obviously, I'm not a marketing person. They would be more eloquent than me. But the trouble is, we're at a point where not adding a 4G badge to your device is probably the smartphone branding equivalent of suicide. Since the claim is technically accurate, according to Apple, they went with it. Looking at it from a pure business and marketing perspective, then, I think it's hard to blame them. But still, I think the average consumer is going to be a little bit confused. So maybe the answer would be to better separate the 4G from LTE monikers. But I think at this point, many consumers don't make that distinction. And that's likely leading to all of this confusion and frustration. Definitely something that Apple is going to have to address moving forward. In the post-PC era, it looks like Apple is finding that many people are not backing up their iOS devices, and that's caused a little bit of problems for customers coming in to get service at the local Genius Bar. Now it's being reported that Apple is supposedly doing something about it. Apple is reportedly in the early stages of testing a new in-retail store system that would allow Geniuses to back up customers' iOS data right on site. The system is designed to facilitate the ability to do a quick, secure, and temporary local backup of a customer's iDevice in cases where that device may need to be replaced. According to the report, Apple is finding that now that devices are PC-free, many customers arrive for Genius Bar appointments without having sufficiently backed up their device, either via connecting it to a Mac or PC using iTunes or using the new free iCloud service. Apple could have customers sign up and back up to the iCloud right there in store using in-store Wi-Fi, but that process would be too slow and time-consuming. The new system would reportedly serve as a local mini iCloud and let Genius's quickly back up customers' data and then restore it back onto the new replacement device. The whole system seems pretty slick, and one thing that I haven't read about but Apple could do to take the system one step further is they could allow customers to opt in to have that backup performed in-store migrated in the background up into iCloud proper. That way, once they left the store with their new device, they would be already set up for doing incremental iCloud backups, and that would give Apple a way to move customers who aren't currently in a backup system up into the iCloud backup infrastructure. At this point, it's fairly well known that Apple's retail stores are highly successful in generating sales for the company, and we've talked about it before, but Apple does have the best performing retail spaces in the U.S. Simcoe released their latest retail performance numbers, and they show that Apple stores perform 17 times better in sales per square foot than the average mall retailer. Annual store sales in the range of $300 per square foot are considered respectable in the U.S. Apple stores earn on average a whopping $5,626 per square foot. That is unbelievable. That number also more than doubles the performance of the number two U.S. retailer, famous jewelry store Tiffany & Company. Seeing numbers like these, it makes it easy to understand why Apple has worked so aggressively to grow its retail store locations and operations. Also makes sense why Apple's posting phenomenal sales numbers, and it's just something that completely adds to Apple's bottom line and their success. Apple and the Mac's security reputation continued to take a bashing this week. In the wake of the recent flashback exploit, the security firm Kaspersky Lab held a press conference, and they declared that Mac security and vulnerabilities are a myth. You know, despite the source and the fact that I believe no reasonable person would actually declare any computing device immune from exploits, I do think that they have a point. In general, Apple owners, and I think Apple itself, has been far too brash about their security, and the rash of recent attacks targeting the Mac hopefully will serve as a kind of wake-up call. The growth of Mac market share and the high profile of Apple as a company, along with the high profile of their devices, have definitely made the platform a more desirable target for increasingly high-profile attacks. The good news is that I think this stuff is easy to combat if you take it seriously. I think this is evidenced by the fact that Kaspersky also found that only 30,000 Macs remained infected with the flashback Trojan. That was down from over a high of 600,000 Macs that were believed to be affected just like a week ago. I believe the numbers came down quickly because the awareness that rose and all of the coverage that happened. Apple also addressed a hole that had not been patched in the Java core for over 2 months, and that's kind of exactly where the problem lies. There's really no excuse for Apple to have ignored patching OS X for that long, and that this time around they got bit for it. My hope is that they learned a lesson and that this kind of mistake will be avoided in the future. I also do want to note, though, that while Kaspersky and Symantec reports both believe that the flashback infections are really reduced, some researchers are disputing the decline. They claim that the number of infected Macs still remains really high, somewhere in the 600,000 to 650,000 unit range. I think whichever side you believe, though, it's time that the attitudes surrounding security in the Mac do change, especially if you believe reports from places like Trend Micro, which claims that Apple's OS had more exploits than any other platform in the first 3 months of 2012. According to their study, they said that that Apple had 91 reported vulnerabilities compared to just about 43 for Microsoft, which that's a huge shift in how we used to think about security in the operating systems. Apple's always claimed that they take security very seriously, and the Trend Micro report did point out that Apple patched about 83 bugs and security flaws in the Safari web browser recently, but that's just one example over a lot of different exploits that are out there. Apple also has been taking steps to add additional security controls, doing things like adding the Apple ID code signing requirement for App Store apps, enforcing sandboxing in Mac applications, and adding the new gatekeeper security technology to Mac OS X Mountain Lion. All of these are great security steps moving forward, but that really doesn't help a lot of the Macs and systems that are already out there. I talked recently on a MacCast members episode with George Starcher about security and steps that users and Mac owners might take to better protect themselves. And what we talked about and concluded is that security is best handled in sort of layers of protection, meaning small little pieces that you put into place that are layered one on top of each other that as a whole better protect your entire system. This includes making the assumption that you can and may get attacked. This doesn't have to be synonymous with will get attacked, but it's a much better posture than assuming that as a Mac owner or an Apple owner, you're completely immune from any kind of virus or Trojan or any kind of attack. And I hope that me bringing up this story or mentioning these kinds of facts and figures aren't causing any kind of panic in the community. That's not the intent. I'm hoping none of my statements are really confused. I still believe that the Mac is one of the securest platforms that you can use, and iOS for sure has an impeccable security record, but that comes from active efforts to secure the platform, and I think that's something that Apple needs to extend as they're doing this sort of iOS to Mac OS back and forth. That's something that they need to extend to the OS X platform. And they obviously are with Mountain Lion, but they also need to address the issues that there are a lot of Macs and Apple products already out there in the market. And so Apple needs to do things on their end. I think we as customers also need to start raising our awareness and taking a more defensive posture when dealing with security issues. The point here is that we need to keep security a priority. We can never assume that it can be ignored. With the pending transition from MobileMe to iCloud on the way, it looks like Apple is making some efforts to try and get people to upgrade to Lion. One of the steps they appear to be taking is offering free Snow Leopard upgrades to people who are on Leopard. The Apple site MacGasm reported the link to the free upgrade offer. It actually came through an email to customers, to MobileMe customers, about the pending MobileMe to iCloud transition, which happens on June 30th. The trouble is, to run iCloud, you need to have Lion, and to get Lion, you need to have the Mac App Store, and to get the Mac App Store, you have to be running Snow Leopard. So customers who follow the link can log into their MobileMe accounts and fill out a form to request a free Snow Leopard DVD, which normally retails for about US $29.99. The program appears to run through June 15th, 2012, and Apple does seem to be shipping out the DVDs pretty quickly. I had one listener in the UK email me and said that he ordered his DVD late on Thursday. It actually arrived to him Monday morning from the US. So that's a pretty good turnaround time. So if you want to get a free Snow Leopard DVD and you're running Leopard, you might want to take advantage of this program. I'll have a link to the MacGasm article in the show notes at maccast.com. Now, I think this is great, but I still wonder about all those MobileMe customers who still have very capable Mac hardware that won't run Lion. Lion does require that you have 64-bit capable Intel Mac, and there's a lot of older systems out there that are still in use that don't meet those requirements. iCloud not supporting Mac OS X Snow Leopard to me is ridiculous, especially when you consider the fact that iCloud will actually run under Windows Vista, which is an operating system that's older than even Mac OS X Leopard version 10.5. I think it's great that Apple is helping customers with supported hardware and giving them a less expensive path to get upgraded to Lion, but the gesture to me comes off a little bit thin and definitely somewhat self-serving. I see no reason why Apple can't technically support iCloud on the older operating systems. So unless they put out an update for at least Snow Leopard, this move to me seems like a pure play to force a large portion of their customers to go out and have to buy new hardware. I know you could argue that those customers don't have to upgrade and could use alternative services like Google or Dropbox. And I think if Apple does not provide an upgrade path for iCloud for those customers, that's actually exactly what those customers are going to do. And I actually see that as an issue for Apple. There's so many services and companies focused on the cloud right now, and it's a potential big revenue stream moving forward. Obviously, Apple is putting together their iCloud initiative because they want to be part of that business. So I don't really understand how forcing your customers onto another service really serves that end. To me, Apple's decision not to support iCloud on older hardware just seems a little bit baffling. Another thing that was baffling this week was a story that showed up on a Seattle blogger's website. Apparently, he was having some issues with Apple regarding a repair on his MacBook Pro. A blogger going by the handle Seattle Rex sued Apple in small claims court when the company refused to repair his out-of-warranty MacBook Pro. The core of the issue is actually Apple and NVIDIA's recognized flaw with the MacBook Pro that contained the NVIDIA GeForce 8600M GT graphics processors. There was a whole batch of those processors that were admittedly known to be defective from NVIDIA, and they were issuing replacements. Apple issued also an extended warranty program. The units in question are actually 15-inch and 17-inch models manufactured between May 2007 and September 2008. Rex apparently had one of these models, and it started showing signs of the graphics issue about 2 months before his extended AppleCare warranty expired. A month after that, apparently the whole system completely failed and refused to boot. It's the second issue that seems to have caused the problem, because when he took it to the Genius Bar at the Apple store, they refused to recognize the first failure, citing the fact that the entire system wouldn't boot, so they actually couldn't verify that it was the NVIDIA failure that was happening. They said that Rex was liable at that point then for the repairs. He obviously disagreed, and a Seattle judge recently agreed with him. And while the specific details of the settlement weren't given, apparently they did award him enough to cover the costs of a new system, as well as covering some of his legal costs. Apple had actually issued a warranty extension program that covered the NVIDIA GeForce 8600 GT affected models for up to four years from the manufacturing date, and it was Rex's contention that his system should have been covered by that warranty program. If you want to read all the gory details of the entire case, there is a post on his website. I'll link to that in the show notes at maccast.com, but I wanted to talk to you about some of the highlights. Apparently, Apple sent two representatives to plead their case, which seems a little bit excessive for a case that's being tried in small claims court. Rex did opt for arbitration before it actually went into the courtroom, but that obviously failed. Apple claimed that because the CPU in his MacBook Pro was a build-to-order model clocked at the higher rate of 2.6 gigahertz, that it wasn't covered by the standard warranty extension program, which Apple put a press release out and they showed in court that covered the 2.4 gigahertz or 2.5 gigahertz stock models. They said that it was a completely different computer and therefore not subject to the replacement program. Rex countered in court that the chips, logic boards, and CPUs in all of the MacBook Pro models were the same, regardless of whatever the clock speed was. And where Apple got into a little bit of trouble was the judge turned and asked the representatives from Apple if what he was saying was true, and they both admitted yes, and then further conceded that the unit was actually covered by the extended warranty program. Apple had offered to replace the logic board, but Rex argued that replacing the logic board wouldn't help because it would actually end up with the same bad NVIDIA GPU. Again, when the judge asked the Apple representatives to confirm that, they did say that the MacBook Pro models in question, the logic boards, would only accept the NVIDIA GeForce 8600M processor, which I think is what led to the judge finding in Rex's favor. It doesn't help when you're in court and you get caught sort of bending the truth or even flat out lying, as appears to be what happened in this case, at least according to Rex's account. Again, we're only kind of getting one side of the story, so I'm taking everything with a grain of salt. But assuming what he is saying is accurate, and I have no reason to disbelieve him, it again is not very hard to see why he won the case. Now, I'm not 100% sure that replacing the logic board wouldn't have helped, because I think, again, it was just a bad batch of NVIDIA GPUs, and later versions would supposedly have been fixed. Although I can say from personal experience, that's not the experience I have, and I definitely see Rex's point. I had one of these MacBook Pro models, and I had three logic boards replaced before finally Apple swapped it out completely for a new model under this warranty extension program. I think the bigger concern here is why Apple chose to fight this one case so aggressively, especially when it came out that they're not even liable to cover the costs of the replacement. Actually, NVIDIA was footing the bill for replacing the units. So when we hear stories and rumors that AppleCare and Apple support is getting stricter, it's not hard to start to believe some of these, you know, tales and these blog posts and stuff like that. That said, though, I from personal experience, have not noticed these sorts of rumors myself. I don't know much more than what I've read, but I can say that it's definitely not indicative of the stories and experience that I hear from you or that I have myself. To me, it seems like the case is really just one of these isolated incidents where it kind of got out of hand, and then the media picked up on it and kind of blew things up to make good headlines and to attract eyeballs. I mean, that sort of thing happens. That's not to say that Apple didn't screw up in this one particular incident. I think obviously they did, and I'm glad that Rex chose not to back down and fought for what he felt was right. But to conclude based on this one incident that there's some sort of major problem with Apple's customer service, I don't think is right either. If this were the case with every customer experience, or even if, say, 10% of customer experiences were playing out like this incident did, then I think we definitely would have a problem. But I have seen no evidence to that fact, nor have I heard any evidence to support that claim. As a matter of fact, I'd probably have more evidence to support the counter argument, and that this was simply one bad screw-up of one support case at one Apple store. So that's not to say there aren't more Rex stories out there, but I think as an overall percentage of positive versus negative stories, we can kind of chalk this one up as another one of those isolated incidents. It's a little bit made a little bit more bizarre by the fact that Apple chose to fight it so aggressively, but you know, until I have some sort of different experience, all my experiences have been really positive, or until I start to hear from a lot of people that Apple is taking this tact, I think we don't generally have to worry about it too much. And as I said at the top of the show, Apple is gearing up for its second quarterly results call of 2012, and by most accounts, that should be a very positive reporting. Canaccord Genuity, however, reported that iPhone 4S sales do appear to be slowing in developed markets, although that's not really surprising because we've had a lot of reports that Apple is gearing up for the next generation iPhone to come out around the October timeframe, and customers in developed markets generally will start to hold back on new device purchases in preparation for the next generation device. As far as what we'll hear at Apple's results call on Tuesday, most analysts are predicting very good results. Goldman Sachs, as a matter of fact, expects solid numbers for Apple's Q2. They say they expect sales of 31.1 million iPhones in the quarter, along with 12.5 million iPads. And while iOS sales should be strong, they're calling Mac sales potentially lackluster. I found this a little bit odd because the numbers they expect are 4.3 million units with a 14% annual year-over-year growth, and I think that's well above any numbers we've seen recently from most other PC makers. And while Goldman Sachs is not impressed with quarterly Mac sales, they do expect those sales to rebound in the next quarter as Apple releases newer models with the latest Intel Ivy Bridge technologies. Chris Whitmore over at Deutsche Bank is a bit more conservative in his iOS numbers, but a bit more bullish on Macs. He says he expects to see sales of 26 million iPhones and 10 million iPads, along with 4.5 million Macs. He also expects that Apple will beat consensus revenue and earnings per share estimates of $35.9 billion and $9.78 per share, respectively. Brian White with Topeka Capital Markets is also estimating big numbers in a similar range. He says 29.6 million iPhones and 11.58 million iPads sold in the quarter. In general, Apple's stock price has been very volatile in the lead up to the Tuesday results call, dropping pretty sharply last week on Tuesday. That caused a bit of concern, but most believe that this is the typical profit-taking that happens in the lead-up to Apple's earnings results call. In general, I would say that we can expect Apple to post their now almost typical positive results on Tuesday. I already pointed out that most sites and rumor blogs believe that Apple will be releasing the next generation iPhone 5 sometime in the fall, September-October timeframe, and of course, that means that iPhone 5 rumors continue to gain steam. The Korean site ET News claims that Apple will finally take advantage of a 2010 deal that gave them exclusive rights to the technology developed by a company called Liquid Metal. To date, it's believed that Apple has only used the metal technology in the SIM ejection tool that was included with the iPhone 3GS, although although this tool was eventually changed to a more standard material with later models. It's now believed that the back case on the next generation iPhone could use liquid metal technology. The reason is that it has advantages. The material is lightweight, stronger, and harder than titanium, but it actually has more elasticity, maintaining its shape better and absorbing impacts better under stress. It also has some unique acoustic properties that Apple could take advantage of. Another advantage of the material is that its atomic structure is actually more like glass than metal, and so it can be molded like plastic into final parts that require very little finishing. That could help speed up the manufacturing process and also simplify it, something that is critical when you're trying to produce a high volume of devices. And while the idea that Apple may finally take advantage of the liquid metal technology is exciting, the ET News piece does seem to fall apart a bit when they claim that Apple will announce the next generation iPhone at WWDC in June. WWDC has always taken place in June, but so far this year, the event and the date for the event has not been announced. ET News also has a pretty spotty track record when it comes to Apple rumors. I think there's probably little doubt that Apple will do something to improve the processor in the next generation iPhone, and Apple partner Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation is reportedly ramping up their 28 nanometer mobile chip manufacturing, although at this point there's no evidence that Apple would actually use the technology yet. There were some rumors at one point that Apple was considering it for their next generation ASICs processors, but anytime you go through a new manufacturing process, it can pose some challenges. Add to that the fact that Apple's A5 dual-core chips and even the new A5X chip in the new iPad still use Samsung's 45 nanometer process, and the rumor starts to become less likely. As a matter of fact, the A5 in the new Apple TV was revealed recently to use a 32 nanometer chip, making it significantly smaller than the A5 that's in the iPad 2, but so far, that's actually Apple's only A-series chip reportedly using a non-45 nanometer process. Chips using smaller nanometer designs, of course, are more energy efficient and reduce heat, which is desirable in mobile devices and likely something Apple would want in a next generation iPhone, but they're also more costly and tend to have lower yield rates, especially in the earlier stages of developing the manufacturing process, and considering the fact that TSMC just started ramping up their 28 nanometer production, they might not be ready for a fall release in the next generation iPhone. Because the iPhone would have large demand and Apple likes to maintain their healthy profit margin on iPhones, I also think it's more likely that we would see another 45 nanometer design or possibly a 32 nanometer design in Apple's A6 chip. I guess it's also possible that they could go with the new iPad's A5X chip, but my guess is that they want a little bit more bang for their buck out of a next generation processor, especially if they plan to stay one step ahead of the competition. I think another point that's not really up for debate with regard to the specs of the next generation iPhone is that it will support 4G LTE networks. Reuters, however, is reporting that Qualcomm may have trouble meeting Apple's chip demands. The odd thing about the report, though, is that they say the delays would push the iPhone launch back to potentially September or October, which is exactly the launch date that most of us are expecting for the next generation device. So I have a feeling everything's on track for the new iPhone to have 4G LTE support. DigiTimes claims that the next generation iPhone displays will be supplied by Sharp and Toshiba Mobile Display. The rumor is that the next generation screens are actually going to use something called in-cell touch panels that will allow them to merge the LCD and touch panels into a single unit. The newer designs would be much better in terms of touch response and also be thinner and lighter, allowing Apple to slim down the design of the next generation iPhone. The only concern with Apple moving to the new technology is again the fact that the panels would be a bit more expensive and also would be produced at slightly lower yield rates, although Apple typically overcomes the yield issues by tapping multiple suppliers. The trouble there is that neither of Apple's current suppliers, TPK Holdings or WinTech, can currently produce in-cell panels. TPK is actually developing an alternative technology called touch-on-lens that can scale up to larger displays, but they say that won't be ready for production until late this year, which is likely why DigiTimes is reporting that Sharp and Toshiba Mobile Display have actually been tapped to supply the next generation displays. And in case you weren't excited already about the iPhone 5 launch, Piper Jaffray analyst Gene Munster in a Bloomberg video called the next iPhone the, quote, mother of all upgrades. It seems like a big claim, but Munster is typically reliable in his predictions, so I have a feeling we've got something pretty large coming in the fall. And not to be ignored, of course, the 7-inch iPad rumors seem to continue. They don't seem to want to go away. This time around, a Chinese blog claims that Apple will ship a 7.85-inch device in the third quarter, priced at between US $250 and $299. The idea here is that it would be a tablet to compete with the new lower-priced Android tablets that are hitting the market. I still have a hard time swallowing this one. About the only way I believe this rumor is if it's some sort of supersized iPod Touch style device focused on media and gaming, and even then, for me, it's a really, really, really huge stretch. I know some of you think that Apple's going for the smaller tablet, and we've heard some strong rumors from some pretty reliable sources. Most recently, it was John Gruber at Daring Fireball, although I still think that that was focused on the fact that Apple has 7-inch devices in its labs on campus at Apple, which I have no doubt that they do. I think Apple tests and plays around with a number of different form factors, but I don't necessarily think that means they're going to release those devices. I think that has a lot more to do with market conditions and how much Apple thinks they can make an impact in a particular segment. And right now, the low-end tablet market seems to be taken up by devices like the Kindle Fire. I don't think there's a lot of profit margin in it, which is another factor that Apple weighs pretty heavily when they start making these decisions, and plus the fact that the current iPads are selling extremely well and making a lot of money for the company. It's hard for me to swallow that this is a market that Apple really wants to enter. I think they're focused on other devices and making impacts in other areas. But I guess we'll know come the third quarter, come this fall, if I'm right or not. And if you have an opinion on it, please shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But that's going to do it for the news for this week. Going to kick off the feedback section with a little update on my iPhone unlock saga. I think I told you about last episode that I had unlocked my iPhone 3GS through the new official AT&T unlock procedure. I talked a little bit about that process. But I did this week get a kind of follow-up question from Brad.
Hi, Adam. My name is Brad Miller. Thanks so much for all you do with the MacCast. I have about an hour drive into LA once a week, and you always keep me company and keep me awake at 4 a.m. So thanks so much. Hey, wanted to thank you for what you said about the AT&T iPhone unlock. I did go through that process. Took me about 4 days to get a final email saying to hook up my iPhone to iTunes and it would be unlocked. I never got any kind of a confirmation when I did that, and was wondering if you knew if there was a way to confirm or verify that the iPhone is indeed locked. Maybe a different software revision number or something, but I can't seem to find any way to verify that it's unlocked. Searched around a bit on the internet, couldn't find much either. So I would love to hear what you have to say about that, and thanks again for the MacCast.
Hey, Brad, you're welcome, and glad I could be along for the ride with your commute and help you out with that. But as far as the AT&T unlock goes, after you receive that email, you do need to connect your device to iTunes, and then you do need to perform a backup and then a restore of your device. You have to do a full restore, and then when it reboots and reconnects itself back to iTunes, you should see on the display in iTunes a message that says something like, congratulations, your device is now unlocked. And as far as I know, that's the only indicator to indicate that you do have an unlocked device. As far as like looking in the about screen or any information in iTunes, it really doesn't look any different after it's unlocked than it did before. So the only place you'll see it is when you do that restore. And it does come back up. If you've already tried a restore and didn't see that message, you could restore the device again, and it should come up every time you restore the device. And that's where I saw mine and how I know my device is unlocked. So I hope that helps you out. I do want to follow up and talk a little bit about what to do now that you have your device unlocked. I had asked for some suggestions from you to find out, you know, what kinds of carriers, what kind of pay-as-you-go plans, maybe some MVNO plans, mobile virtual network operator plans that I could get on in the U.S. that might be worthwhile in looking into. And I received some great feedback. It sounds like the two that most people are recommending are either T-Mobile, and the dilemma there is, of course, the data network, or something called Straight Talk. And so I've ordered SIMs from both companies. I actually already received my Straight Talk SIM, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that process in today's episode. So what I did was I went to straighttalk.com, and Straight Talk, for those of you in the United States who are familiar with TracFone, Straight Talk is actually the same company that's TracFone. Now, TracFone is in grocery stores and I think Walmart and stuff like that, and they're focused on pure feature phones and really low-cost, pay-as-you-go feature phones. Straight Talk is their initiative to bring that kind of pay-as-you-go functionality onto smartphones, and they do sell exclusively, I believe, through Walmart. Through Walmart, you can only get either the phone or the top-up cards, but if you want to actually get a new SIM, you have to go through the website. And through the website, the SIM costs $15 US, $14.99. And they had free overnight shipping, so I got mine pretty quickly. I also got it along with my first 30 days of coverage. And what they're offering is, I think they have a couple different plans, but if you want to use data, the one most people are going to be interested in is the $45 a month plan. It's $45. It covers you for 30 days. And you get unlimited talk, unlimited texting, and what they call unlimited data, although it's not quite truly unlimited. And that's because the reality is that Straight Talk, at least for their GSM phones, runs on the AT&T network. They're actually an MVNO, mobile virtual network operator, on the AT&T network. So something interesting about the Straight Talk plans is that technically, if you have an AT&T GSM iPhone, you don't even need to really unlock the device. You can actually, if you're off contract, just take advantage of the Straight Talk plans. So that might be an option for some of you, especially if you don't even want to bother unlocking your device. But now that it's easy enough to unlock it, you know, just putting in a request to AT&T, you might as well go ahead and do that anyway. But I did get the SIM. Oh, and on the data side of things, because again, it's AT&T's network, there is this sort of soft limit of 2 gigabytes. Now, when I was doing the research online, it was unclear whether or not when you hit that 2 gigabyte limit, if they would simply just throttle you. In some cases, some people were reporting that Straight Talk actually did drop certain customers after they reached that 2 gigabyte limit. So unlimited, not truly unlimited, as we're becoming more and more used to, unfortunately, in the US. But for those of you who use 2 gigabytes or data or less and want unlimited talk and unlimited data, this might be a pretty attractive plan at $45 a month. As far as how the process worked once I received the package, actually activating the SIM and getting the phone and the texting bits up and working was fairly straightforward. The package came in the mail, and you just go on the Straight Talk website. There's a little serial number that you plug in to activate the SIM. Once the SIM is activated, all you have to do is pop that into the phone. So extract the old SIM using the SIM ejector tool and then put in the new SIM. In my case, this was an iPhone 3GS, so it was the full-size SIM. They also do offer the micro SIM, so if you have an iPhone 4 that qualifies, you could use that as well. And once I had the SIM in place, the phone bits started working almost immediately. The texting bits started working almost immediately. But the one thing that wasn't working was the data. And the reason for that is, and the instructions in the Straight Talk package are also very clear on this, is the fact that you have to update what is called the access point name in the device itself, the APN. And this actually proved to be the most frustrating part of the process for me, because both on the Straight Talk website and actually on Apple's own support website, they had instructions for how to update the APN information on an iPhone running iOS. Unfortunately, the instructions on Apple's website, and I'll link to these in the show notes at maccast.com, said to go into the iPhone, go into the settings under general, under network, and then into the cellular data network options and adjust the information, put in the information that's provided by Straight Talk. In my case, at least running iOS 5.1, when you go to that screen, the only option for cellular data network is to either turn it on or turn it off. There is no way to put in any kind of settings, let alone APN settings, into that area. So I spent a long time searching online, trying to find a solution. I tried to use Apple's older iPhone configuration utility, which you can actually download from their support website. I was able with that to actually build a profile and put in the settings information for the APN, but I couldn't find any way to install it onto the phone. I connected my phone via USB cable, and the options to actually load the profile were always grayed out. Finally, I was able to use Apple's newer Apple Configurator tool, which is the one that you download from the App Store. But even using that and figuring out how to add and configure the profile was a little bit confusing. It wasn't straightforward. So in case there's any of you who want to go through this process, I'll tell you how I did it. I downloaded the Apple Configurator tool from the Apple Store. And then once I had that, I ran it. And when it comes up, the first tab that you're in is the Prepare section. And within the Prepare section, there's a little plus icon in the profile area where you can add a profile. I clicked to add a profile. I gave it a name. And then you double-click on the profile to go in and configure all the different settings. Now, there's a bunch of different options and things that you can plug in there. In this case, I was only interested in the APN section. So go ahead and scroll down to the APN area and click on that, and then you'll see the fields where you can enter the information that Straight Talk gives you. Now, it turns out, in my research, I discovered that you really only need to enter one bit of information, and that's the access point name. And in this case, it's att.mvno. So you put that into the access point field, and you click Save, and that's really it. There is an option and a space to put in the proxy server and the port for Straight Talk, and Straight Talk does provide that information to you, but it does show that it's optional, and I found that you didn't need to enter that information to have it to have the profile work. So once you've done that and you've saved to send the profile to your device, you need to connect the device via USB cable and then check the profile in that prepare screen, and then down at the bottom there's a little prepare button. You click on that, and it'll start loading the profile onto your device. On the device itself, a confirm screen will come up, and you need to confirm and click install, and then once that's done, it should be loaded onto the device, and that should be it. The only other odd thing that I found is that in the Apple Configurator tool, I did need to click on the stop button because it just kept spinning indefinitely, even though the profile was already loaded onto my device. But then on the device itself, you can confirm the profile is loaded by going into Settings under General, and then looking at profile, and you should see the profile information there. You can drill in and see that it does have the APN settings. And once I had that profile loaded on my iPhone 3GS, then I was able to access the data network, and everything seems to be working as expected. But as I mentioned, it was a little bit of a process to get that whole thing working. And I think it's a little more technical than most consumers should have to go through. So it's still just frustrating that the process has to be this complicated and technical. I will tell you that a number of people pointed me to a New Zealand website that already has the profiles that you can simply download from the iOS device and install. I wanted to go the official route, and I don't like downloading files from, you know, random websites onto my device. It's just one of my security concerns. Although I have to say, I have a feeling it's safe for most people, but it was from an unlocking site, a New Zealand unlocking site, and I just really wasn't comfortable doing that. But once again, it's up and running now, and so I immediately wanted to do some speed tests, especially with the data, so I loaded up the speedtest.net app on both my iPhone 4S and my iPhone 3GS, made sure I was on the mobile network, and did some comparisons, and I did find that the download speeds were pretty comparable. On my iPhone 4S, I was getting download speeds of about 2 to 2.5 megabits per second. On the iPhone 3GS with the Straight Talk plan and the data, it was comparable, about a half a megabit per second less on average, I would say. But the upload speeds, there was a huge difference. They were actually horrible on the Straight Talk plan, and I'm not really sure why that is. I probably still need to do some troubleshooting, but I was able to get upload speeds on the 3GS on Straight Talk of about 0.2 megabits per second. That's versus between 1 to 1.5 megabits per second on my iPhone 4S running a standard AT&T SIM. So again, not really sure why the discrepancy there, but definitely something to be concerned or actually think about. The only other thing that I noticed with the Straight Talk plan is that the network indicator up in the menu bar where it would normally say AT&T simply says the word home. I think there might be a way to hack that in, especially if you have a jailbroken device. But again, this is just a stock AT&T officially unlocked phone. So if that bothers you, just be aware of that. As I said, I do have a T-Mobile SIM on order, and I will let you know how that compares once I receive it, both in terms of the setup process and the data speeds, although I obviously expect the data speeds to be pretty poor because with the T-Mobile plan, it does run on a 2G Edge network. And the plan that T-Mobile offers is a better deal. It's actually $30 a month pay-as-you-go, but for that, you only get 100 talk minutes per month and unlimited text and unlimited data. So if you're not planning on using a lot of talk minutes, it might be a viable plan for you. And I'm not sure if those roll over or not. I don't think they do. I think they reset every month. But at $30 a month, that's a pretty good for unlimited texting and unlimited data, especially if it's truly unlimited, even if it's at a slower speed. But so far, that's been my experience with unlocking. I'm still looking for alternative carriers and things like that. So if you have a bit of advice, somebody other than Straight Talk or T-Mobile, let me know. I know there's a lot of regional carriers. I'm in Southern California in San Diego, so just be aware of that. You know, I might not have every option available to me in terms of MVNO networks. So I know that a lot of people really like the Growl software and the Growl notification system that you can get for Mac OS X. It's actually used by a lot of third-party apps to display little notifications and bits of information. And one of those notifications that a lot of people like is the ability for iTunes to show the currently playing track as you're listening to music. Well, Cult-O-Mac has detailed a cool little terminal hack for Mac OS X Lion that allows you to get that functionality for the dock icon, but without having to install Growl. And so I thought this was pretty neat. I'll have a link to the Cult of Mac piece in the show notes at maccast.com. But if you're running Lion, you can get this little pop-up of the currently playing track info. And the way you do it is with a little terminal hack. So I will also have the terminal commands in the show notes at maccast.com. But those of you who are familiar with this stuff, the terminal command is defaults space write space com.apple.doc. And then space iTunes dash notifications space dash bool space in the word yes. And so you enter that command and then you need to restart your dock by issuing the kill all space dock command. And then once you've done that, when you're playing a track in iTunes, when it jumps to the next track, it'll pop up this sort of little growl style notification right next to or right above your iTunes dock icon. And so it's pretty cool. If you want to turn it off, you run the same terminal command, but instead of yes, you tell it no at the end, and then again, reset your dock and you're back to normal. And for those of you who aren't comfortable doing a terminal hack and prefer a GUI way of doing this, it actually is also supported by the Secrets System Preference pane, which I've told you about in the past. That allows you to issue a lot of these terminal hacks, but do it through a system preferences panel. You can find that at secrets.blacktree.com. And the specific thing that you'll look for is enable iTunes pop-up notifications. You turn that on and just click the little quit this icon down at the bottom of the system preference pane, which will restart your dock and you'll have this feature enabled. And that might be a little bit more comfortable way for some of you to implement this hack. But either way, thought it was a pretty cool hack and wanted to share that with you. Now, I think I covered this trick a while back on the MacCast, but it came up again this week when my wife was working on a PDF in Pages and needed to create a version that she wanted to email. It was a document that had a number of images in it that were taken with our digital camera. which, you know, it's pretty high megapixel camera, so the images that were embedded were fairly large. And so when she generated the PDF, even though the images were scaled down in pages, it did produce a pretty large PDF, something larger than she was comfortable emailing. And so I thought I'd cover how to reduce the file size of PDFs in Mac OS X. And a common way to produce PDFs in Mac OS X, and actually the method that my wife was using, was to simply go to the print menu and then use the PDF options to save the document as a PDF rather than actually printing it. The problem there is that it looks like it sort of embeds the full size images, and so you might want to actually shrink that PDF down. Now, there's a couple of third-party tools that I found as I was doing research that you could use, something called PDF Shrink and another application called PDF Compress. Both of these are paid-for applications, and I will have links to them in the show notes at maccast.com. There's actually even a couple of web-based services that you can use that I ran across where you just upload the PDF to, you know, through a web form, and it'll generate and send back a compressed or a smaller PDF to you. But if you use Pages, it turns out there's an even easier built-in way to kind of shrink down the size of your exported PDF. And the way you do it is, rather than going through the print menu and exporting the PDF from there, if you just use Pages' built-in PDF export feature, you can actually control the size of the export at least a little bit, because it gives you some options for adjusting the quality of the exported PDF. And in essence, this relates to how it's going to generate the embedded images in terms of the compression. So you can change it from best to better to good, and you can yield different file savings depending upon those settings. And you can play around with them to see what the best balance between image quality and file size actually is. But if you're actually just going to put it in an email, and you're actually going to have, you know, the document's going to be viewed just online or on the web, you can pretty much go with the good setting and get a pretty small PDF generated. I believe when I did this with my wife's PDF, it went from about 13 megabytes all the way down to just a couple hundred kilobytes. So some significant savings in terms of the file size. But once again, it's going to depend upon your output. Another method you could use, though, is to use Preview, and in its export options, there's actually a ColorSync Quartz filter for optimizing the file size. Now, from what I remember, at one point, this Quartz ColorSync filter used to be in the print dialog box inside most applications, but it looks like now, at least in Mac OS X Lion, it's not in there by default. So the way to get this working in most OS X applications is actually to once again go through the print dialog and then go down to the PDF menu, and then you can select Open PDF in Preview. When you do that, it's automatically going to make a copy of your document as a PDF and open that up in the Preview application. And then once inside Preview, what you can do is you can go into the File menu and go to Export. And then when the Export pane comes down, you'll see the ColorSync Quartz filter options there. You pull that drop down and you will notice there's a reduce file size option under the Quartz filter settings. Select that and press save, and what that is going to do is it's going to export your PDF, but then compress all of the document images using medium quality JPEGs, which will reduce the file size. Now, obviously, once again, depending upon the application that you need, medium quality JPEGs may or may not be desirable. You might need something a little bit higher quality. So say you were sending this to someone and you knew that they were going to want to make a hard copy and print it out. Medium quality JPEGs might not look good enough. Or if it was maybe an art portfolio piece you were sending to someone as a PDF, medium quality JPEGs might not be good enough quality, and you might want to strike a better balance between the image quality and the file size. Well, luckily, you can actually create your own Quartz filters in Mac OS X, and you can control the quality of those JPEGs. So you can create your own little version of this that you can put inside the ColorSync Quartz filter menu. And the way you do this is you use the ColorSync utility that's in Mac OS X, and you'll find it in your Applications folder under Utilities, under ColorSync utility. So you launch that application and then switch to the filters pane, And then down in the lower left, you just click on the little plus button, and this is going to create a new quartz filter. You give the filter a name, something like maybe reduce PDF size, high quality, and hit return. And then to the right of the filter's name, you're going to choose the little down arrow, and a menu will pop up. And from the pop-up menu, you can choose add image effects component. And you add that, and then from that menu, you can select image compression. And there you can adjust the image compression mode, set it to JPEG, and then you'll have the image compression quality that you can control and you can set however you prefer. And once you're done with that, by default, the ColorSync utility is going to save your filter to the filters in your personal filters folder, which you'll find inside your home library folder. So when you're finished, go ahead and save that. But you're going to need to move this if you want to be able to access it from that PDF menu in preview. You're going to need to move that to the library folder inside the PDF services folder. And that's the default library folder at the root of your hard drive. So the first step in doing this is to get to the document or the file that is inside your home library filters folder. And in OS X Lion, as we've talked about in the past, that folder is actually hidden by default. So the easiest way to get to it is to hold down the Option key and choose Library from the Finder's Go menu. Once you've done that, you can go into that library folder, go into the filters folder, and find this ColorSync filter that you've just saved. And then you're going to go ahead and you're going to move that to the root library PDF services folder. And probably the easiest way to get to that is to once again also go through the Go menu in the Finder, choose Go to Folder, and then enter /library/PDF services. That should open that up right in the Finder. And then you can simply copy your quartz filter from the home library filters folder over to the root library PDF services folder. And once you drop it in there, it's probably going to ask you to authenticate with an admin account. So you'll have to enter those credentials and it'll copy the file over. And at that point, now you're ready to access that new quartz filter from the Save As menu or the Export menu in Preview. It's actually available in both places. So the next time you're working on a PDF document in Preview and you want to compress it down, you can choose Export and then from the quartz filters, select the new filter that you just built with your new image settings and control the quality. And you can set up multiple versions of these, obviously, using the same technique. So that's how you reduce the PDF file sizes in Mac OS X using some kind of built-in methods. Now, here's a cool little trick that I discovered recently. And actually, the way you would use this trick typically is if you run a computer lab or you have a Mac that's set up as a public terminal someplace in a space where you'd want somebody to be able to accept an acceptable use policy saying that, hey, if you're going to use this machine, you agree to follow these rules and, you know, abide by this sort of policy that we've had set in place. But, you know, even if you don't do that, this is kind of a fun and pretty easy hack that you can do to make a little message pop up in front of the standard login dialog that you get in Mac OS X. And I actually found this trick over on Cult of Mac, so I'll have a link to that original piece in the show notes at maccast.com. But in essence, all you have to do is create a file in TextEdit and then save it to a specific location in Mac OS X. I know this works in Lion. I'm not sure how far back this one goes, but it allows you to then detail all the terms of use, and you can even set this up as a rich text document so it can contain images and text and formatting and all that kind of fun stuff. So what you do is you open up TextEdit and you create a document, you put whatever content you want your policy to say, and then you save that document and you give it a really specific name. You call it Policy Banner, all one word with a capital P and a capital B. So Policy Banner, and you can save it as a plain text file, as a TXT file, as a rich text formatted file, an RTF file, or even a rich text formatted directory file, RTFD, which I believe if you create a rich text document using TextEdit, I think that's the default file format. So you save it as that file format, give it that specific name, And you're going to want to save it at first to your desktop. And then once you have it on your desktop, you're going to go ahead and copy that file into the library security folder. And that's the library folder, the root library folder. So again, you can bring that up by going to the Finder's Go menu, selecting Go to Folder, and typing /library/security. And that should open it up in the Finder. And then you can drag that file, that policy banner file, into that directory. And when you do that, once again, it's going to ask you to authenticate with an admin username and password. Enter that information in, and you're all set. At that point, the next time that you log out of your Mac or you restart your Mac and it starts up, you're going to see that document pop up in a little window with an accept button at the bottom of the window. And you have to click accept. And then once you've done that, it will take you to the standard login window. I will tell you that I tried this on my Mac. And when I did it, I think this is really a fluke, but I just want to give this warning. When I first tested this out, the first time I saved it and then logged out of my Mac, I got a gray screen and my whole Mac locked up. And then I had to do a hard reset. And when the Mac rebooted, it did take a while, but eventually the policy came up just fine. The login box came up just fine and everything seemed to work from that point forward. And then subsequent reboots and log outs and log back ins, the Mac behaved normally. But just wanted to throw that out there in case one of you runs into that problem. Don't panic. It seems to be fine. But I think in my case, it was something specifically related to my system. I don't expect many of you to have this problem because this hack is relatively benign. I think it's built-in functionality designed for those people who run computer labs and things like that. And it should work just straight out of the box without issues. But just something fun to kind of play around with. Recently, for a MacCast member program, I wanted to dive in and cover some more obscure, kind of lesser known Mac OS X Lion tips. I realized that I've run across a bunch of tips that I've seen a number of different places, but I wanted to find some that maybe a lot of us didn't know. And so I covered a whole series of those on a recent episode. And for those of you who don't know what the MacCast member program is that's a way you can support the MacCast for a few dollars a month. You get extra shows each week, and they typically tend to be more in-depth coverage of a topic or a lot of hints and tips and tricks, a lot of the kinds of things that we cover here in the back half of the MacCast. But if you want to find out more information about that or check it out, you can go to member.maccast.com and get all of the details. But regardless, on this last episode or on a recent episode, I think it was the last one, I covered a bunch of these Lion tips. And there were one or two of them that I thought were particularly useful and kind of fun that I wanted to share with you. So you can kind of also get a flavor of the kinds of things that we cover on MacCast members episodes, some of the additional content that you might expect. And one of the tips that I ran across was the ability with Launchpad, you know, the little thing that brings up the iOS style application launcher, the ability to actually control and change the background that comes up behind your window. By default, the background behind Launchpad is typically a colored, blurred version of whatever is on your Mac OS X desktop. And you can actually change it to be either not blurred or grayscale using a simple keyboard shortcut once it's been activated. And so the options that you get are a colored blurred background, a colored not blurred background, grayscale, or a grayscale blurred background. And so to change it, what you do is you activate Launchpad either from the dock or using the special key or by using a keyboard shortcut. And then once the Launchpad is activated, you press Control Command Option B. The letter B is in boy. And this is if you're running macOS 10.7.3 or later. And you hit that keyboard shortcut and you'll notice it'll start to cycle through the different styles of backgrounds. Prior to the 10.7.3 update, you would just use the Command plus B keys. So if you're running an older version of Lion, just hit Command B and it should toggle through the same kinds of settings. And you can toggle through it. Each time you press it, it'll go to a different mode. You can find the one that you like and then it'll stick on that. So the next time that you launch Launchpad, it'll use that style of background versus the default. So that was a tip that I was totally unaware of and just discovered recently. Another one that I thought was particularly fun was the ability to bring up the autocomplete menu whenever you'd like. So a feature of Mac OS X Lion was the fact that it has the iOS style kind of autocomplete, autocorrection. And you can turn that off if you don't like it. Some people choose to turn it off, but maybe there might be situations where you want to get a suggestion. So if you're like me, you're a particularly bad speller, you might want to be able to start to type the way you think a word is spelt and have it pop up maybe some options for autocomplete. And so to do that in Mac OS X, what you can do is in TextEdit or most text applications, just start typing the first few characters and then hit the F5 key, and that will bring up the autocomplete menu, and then you can scroll through the list, find the word that you're looking for, select it, and then hit enter to automatically insert it into your document. So pretty easy, simple little trick, but incredibly useful, again, if you need that sort of thing, especially for those of us who can't spell. So a couple of tips from that latest episode that I thought you might enjoy. And if you want, check out the MacCast member program over at member.maccast.com. Last thing I wanted to talk to you about this week was the battery indicator on iOS. And this is because I have to admit that I am as obsessed with the percentage indicator on my iOS devices, and I really don't know why, because in reality, I probably should just turn it off. You know, if you go into iOS, into the settings under general, under usage, there's the battery percentage switch, and you can turn it on or off. And once Apple enabled this feature, it used to be we didn't have a percentage. We just had, you know, the icon, and it would get smaller and smaller as you used up your battery, but you really didn't know how much battery you had left. Apple added the percentage thing, and I've turned it on and left it on since then on all my iOS devices. The problem is that it's not always that accurate. And I received an email from John, and he kind of illustrated the core of the problem when he noticed that with his new iPad, he would take it off of charging, it would be at 100%, and then it would rapidly drop down to 95%. And he thought it was pretty odd, and he started playing around with different things and found that if he did a hard reset on his iPad by holding down the home and the sleep wake buttons until it actually rebooted, when it would come back up, the percentage would jump back up to 100%. And in some cases, he could even get it to jump up almost 8% just by doing a hard reset. And I have a feeling the reason for this is that I've heard that the algorithms and the methods for actually determining the battery percentage, the amount remaining in the battery cells, just aren't that accurate. And to be kind of clear, it's actually not the math that's the problem. It's simply the number of variables that go into the equation and how frequently those variables are changing in terms of trying to determine what the remaining battery life, you know, in that cell might be. So you have to do all this mathematical formulas, and then you've got all these variables that are constantly changing. So my guess is that by resetting the system, or when you pull it off of 100% charge, being fully charged, you know, things are kind of zeroed out within the iPad. But as stuff starts to come up and as more of these variables start feeding into the equation, it starts, you know, affecting how accurate that battery percentage is. So you have things going on like your network connection. Are you connected to Wi-Fi or 3G? And what kind of background processes are running and how many are running? And are you using Wi-Fi and is Bluetooth on? And what's your cell signal strength? And what's the antenna strength? And are GPS and location services on? And CPU and memory? And all of these things are going in to affect that equation. And so it ends up being not that accurate, and it's probably why you see a rapid jump on the front end. And I've always noticed this, that it always seems to go from 100% down to 90, 80% relatively quickly and then kind of slows down as you get closer to zero. And so this kind of thing is the kind of thing for someone like me who obsesses over that battery percentage. It drives you completely nuts. And I would say the answer is probably to stop doing that. What you need to do is just ignore it. Frankly, I think it might be best if we could just block out the whole battery indicator altogether. Okay, let's not get too crazy. We need to know how much battery is there so we know when to, you know, plug in when it's down to like 10%. But beyond it getting to the point where it says you're at 10%, your battery's about to run out, you need to plug in now, I think outside that range, you probably don't need to worry about it too much. Because what really should matter is the overall usage time you get out of the device. And I have to say, with my new iPad, for example, it easily goes 2 to 3 days without a charge, without me having to plug it in, with normal usage. So using it in the normal ways I would, it lasts several days. And regardless of how quickly the percentage drops, it always seems to last about that amount of time. It's not a problem. And so I resist the urge now to run to a power adapter when I see it getting down to 60% or 50% and thinking, oh, I got to plug in. I just let it go. And typically I'm finding that I get about exactly what Apple says, around 10 hours of actual usage time out of the battery. And I found the same thing to be true with my iPhone. And so while facts and figures and stats and indicators and all these things are really nice to have, I find that going off real world experience tends to help keep my sanity a little bit better as to when to decide if I actually have a battery issue or not. So I think that percentage indicator probably causes more problems for Apple than it really helps, because it gives the impression that there's some sort of thing wrong with your battery. And I would just urge you that if you think that's the case with your device, try turning off the percentage indicator for a while and just use it normally, and actually track how many active hours on Wi-Fi you're actually getting and see if it doesn't match or at least get close to what Apple's stated battery life for your device is. And I have a feeling you'd be pretty surprised. So just wanted to point that out, and that's the last thing I had for you today. So with that, that's going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show's sponsors. Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software, get more information and details over at Phoronix.com. Circus Ponies, try out Notebook. You can get information, details, as well as free trials of the software over at CircusPonies.com. Smile, check out Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label. They also have Text Expander Touch and PDF Pen for the iPad. You can get all the information on their products as well as trials of their Mac applications over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, you can get cash for that old iPhone, iPod, all kinds of Apple products. Get more information and details as well as an offer over at gazelle.com. And VMware, you know, we have to run Windows on our Macs, some of us occasionally, and if you're going to do it, it might as well be easy and seamless. VMware Fusion for Mac makes that possible, and if you use the code MACCAST right now, you'll save 10% on your order. So check that out over at vmware.com/Mac, and a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for your support. If you'd like to support the show further, you can check out the MacCast member program. That's over at member.maccast.com. If you have a question for me, a comment, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode, I love to get your emails. I also love getting audio comments. You can attach an MP3 or any kind of audio file to your email. You send those to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the MacCast website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/themaccast. And that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.